This episode of The Line is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Line, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to Star Trek Picard. I'm Justin Ozer, and join with me today are my co-hosts, Chrissy DeClercq-Zalagi and Brandon Shea Matala. Brandon, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really good, but I think you were eating a spinach and feta omelet. I can smell it on you.
Really? That's pretty amazing, considering we are definitely not in the same room. We're in different countries, but those olfactory glands are incredible, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, they're pretty amazing. Yes. Chrissy had peanut butter and jelly, I think.
I regularly eat peanut butter and jelly, so that is always a good guess as to what I need.
So other than eating peanut butter and jelly, Chrissy, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's starting to get seasonably warm in Michigan, and then going right past it. So that's just normal.
Okay, awesome.
But I love the summer.
So. Nice. Well, listeners, today on The Line, we have a special guest, Dominic Burgess, who played Mr. Vup on the Star Trek Picard episode Stardust City Rag. So, Dom, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thank you so much. How's it going?
It's going well. It's a pleasure to have you here. It's just always wonderful when we can talk to people that have been involved in the shows and ask them some questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for letting me come and play.
Sure. So let's start out with the question, how did your career in acting start?
Oh, boy. A long time ago. Back in England, I guess I got into it in high school. I went to a school where you had to do some sort of extracurricular activity, and I started out doing rugby, which I hated. I'm a big guy, and I'm 6'5", mm-hmm. and 300 pounds, and at the time I was still a big guy, and so I was playing rugby, and the only way to get out of it, the only thing that clashed with it was drama club. And so when I was in my third year of high school, I said, hey, you know what? I don't want to do rugby anymore. How about that drama club though? And I had no intention of really, I wasn't expecting to enjoy it. And I started and I really enjoyed it. And the first year we did cabaret and I was just ensemble in the background and it was fun and it was silly. And then the next year, we did Death of a Salesman and I played Biff Loman and that was it. From there, I was in, and there was a period where I was going to go to university and study veterinary medicine. And then I was like, no, I'm going to try an audition to go to drama school. And I got a place at my favorite drama school that I auditioned for. And that was it. Then I was on my way.
Dom, you're like my soul twin brother because I'm 6'7", and when I was in high school and a little bit leaner, I was like 250 pounds, and everybody walks up to me and is like, did you ever play football? Did you ever play basketball? You'd be great for sports. And it's like, ugh. Yep.
I got that off all, especially, actually, I moved to America in 2007, and that was, I got that a whole lot. Do you play basketball? Do you play football? A whole lot. When I moved to LA, yeah.
It's amazing when people can just look at you, not know anything about you, and make an assumption like that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
But I did want to ask, you said that you were from Michigan, right, Christy?
Yes, I am.
I went to summer camp. After I finished high school, I went to summer camp to work for the summer in a gap year, and I had the best summer. in Michigan in 2001. I have a special place in my heart for Michigan.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Michigan's a great place in the summer, and if you like it cold, it's a great place in the winter.
Yeah, it was.
If you like it cold. Beautiful.
The thing I remember most about that summer was Jurassic Park 3 was out, and I was in the fortunate/unfortunate position of chaperoning different groups of kids to the movies every couple of days, and so I ended up seeing Jurassic Park 3, oh my gosh, probably around 17 times in one summer.
Wow.
And it was a lot. It was a lot. But I still love it.
Well, Dom, I had more of a general question on one of your acting history moments here. So I absolutely loved The Leftovers, and you got to work on The Leftovers. I don't have a specific question. Can you talk about working on that show? And is it a show that you watched before you were on, or is it something that you watched after you were on the show?
It is something I watched before I worked on it. I'm actually fortunate. A lot of the shows that I work on, I'm a big fan of. And The Leftovers, I loved the first season. And I love the music mm-hmm. from The Leftovers. And I have Max Richter playlist on my phone. And I'll often go down the rabbit hole of getting lost in the music. It was a joy. You know, I went out there for the first episode of the season, and I was just sort of standing in a lake for 2 days mm-hmm. To shoot that opening. And it took a long time to shoot, and it was hot, and they put me in a hat, and I just sort of waded out into the lake. But everyone was so nice. And, you know, sometimes there are shows that you work on that are just a joy to work on. Some shows you work and you sort of feel out the atmosphere and you keep your head down and you just do your job and you go home. But The Leftovers was so lovely. And then I wasn't expecting to go back for the sixth episode of the season. So that was a really, anytime you get a phone call that says, hey, they want you to come back is really delightful. And to work with Regina King, was spellbinding. She's incredible. And actually, funnily, you mentioned The Leftovers. A couple of days ago on Twitter, I posted a couple of monologues from season 3 mm-hmm. that were side by side, and just the way that they shoot them and the storytelling in there. It's such a wonderful show. Mm-hmm. I went off on a tangent, but there you go.
That's quite all right.
I retweeted that one. I saw it and I'm like, yeah, that's like, what an amazing show. And I mean, it seemed to end early, but I am glad that we got that final season, even though it was a bit truncated. But it was one of those
shows.
Wait,
before you go further, for those of us who haven't seen it, what's the premise of the show?
So the original season one premise is 2% of the world's population just literally vanish. They literally just disappear. And it's 3 years later, it's dealing with the ramifications of all these people that have been lost. Mm. And it doesn't sound like a lot of people, but I mean, like, that's one out of every 50 people, two out of every 100 people are just gone and with no answer or anything like that. So each season, though, is like this contained story arc advancing that plot. They all take place in different places, you know, and it goes from like the Mideast USA or whatever it is all the way to Australia by the end of the show. And I don't know, it's a really beautiful show. It's a complex show, and you know, you're left a lot to interpret things because there's a lot of, you know, kind of scenes and stuff that are open to your personal viewer interpretation and whatnot, but there's a lot of faith in the show, and it's really, really interesting. It's a really, really amazing television show.
Yeah, sounds interesting. Yeah,
it's so good.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I'm doing my math right, 2% of the current world population is about 150 million people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
That would have a big impact. Yeah. Wow, sounds interesting.
Yeah, they leave a lot of it open to interpretation, like you said, and I think there's a moment in the second or third season where someone says, well, actually, for the 2% that went missing, it's worse for them because from their perspective, 98% of people went missing. And they sort of establish that there's another Earth, but you're not sure if it's real or not real, or if it's someone telling a lie. And it gets it's really interesting in that way of what you take away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's beautiful. And the acting is so good. And the music is so good. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We got some Stephen, one of my favorite, you know, character actors, Stephen Williams. We got to see him. He was Mr. X on the X-Files. And such an amazing show. I recommend it to anybody. It's like, it's only like 28 episodes, I think, for the whole three seasons. And just amazing, amazing stuff.
That was HBO, wasn't it?
It sure was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Thank you very much for answering that. Thank
you.
Yeah. Cool.
How did you end up with the role of Mr. Vup? Was it something that you sought out, or did they come to you, or something in between?
Oh, I sought it out.
Excellent.
Really, I really, really, really sought it out. I was a big Star Trek fan growing up. I used to do my homework in front of Next Generation on BBC Two and Sky One back in England that it used to play on. And then Voyager is sort of my show, because that was the first one that I watched from pilot to finale as it was airing. And then, I guess when would it have been? Whenever they announced it in the trades, they announced it in Hollywood Reporter or Deadline. And, it was in the news that they were going to work on Picard's show, and they announced it at the convention.
Brandon and I were there at the convention when they announced it.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
2018, yeah.
amazing moment. Like, you've never heard such a noise come from thousands of Star Trek fans. Uh-huh. It was amazing.
So, the moment they announced it, you know, sometimes I'll email my manager and say, like, oh, hey, I heard that they're working on this show, and I'd love to get seen for this. When Patrick Stewart said he was going to go back and play Jean-Luc, I emailed her and I called her and I said, hey, I will play a sliding door in the background on this show. I didn't speak the console. I will do anything to be on the show. And I didn't hold out much hope, because there wasn't a lot of talk about it at the time. And Discovery is shot over in Toronto, and mm-hmm. it's from a casting office that I don't really know. And so I assumed that it was all going to be up in Toronto, and I wouldn't know the people involved. And then, as it started up, I think it had a code name for when it was sort of in the acting breakdowns under Drawing Room. And then I saw who the producers were, and I was like, oh, here we go. This is what it is. And I fortunately knew the casting directors. They had cast me in a show called Feud and American Horror Story, and I knew that office pretty well. And so I wrote them a handwritten letter. I reached out to other casting directors that had worked with them, letting them know, like, hey, I used to run home from high school, and I used to sit down and watch Star Trek, and it means a lot to me. And, then they let me come in and audition, and I had no idea what the role was, because everything was so top secret. They just said it was an alien species. And in my head, I was pacing around my apartment trying to learn lines, saying, well, how can I prepare? Because if it's a Klingon, then it's going to be really different than if it's a Ferengi, and if it's a Cardassian, and if it's this species, then how am I supposed to know how I'm supposed to do it? And then I got in the room, and Liz, the casting director, was like, okay, so you're this big, like 500-pound lizard, and you can't move your neck properly. And I did it sitting down and not being able to move. We did a version in English and British? Don't know if we did. I think they might have specified American. It was, and thankfully the casting office let me have two or three takes, because I got sort of hung up on a little bit of the technobabble in there, and they let me redo it a couple of times. So I'm grateful to them. That was how I got the part.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so grateful, and I loved it.
Oh, that's amazing. That's wonderful. And I just have to say, Dom, I already knew you were a big Star Trek fan because I heard you recently on the Amazing Trek Ranks podcast talking about top five cliffhangers. So I want to say that you're the only person that we've interviewed that's been involved in a show that's been on a podcast like that just goes like so deep into like Star Trek minutiae and picks and stuff like that. So listeners should check that out because it was really cool just to hear that whole episode.
Yeah, and actually, my boyfriend's really mad at me. Not really mad, but I've been tearing through Deep Space Nine on a rewatch. I think I remember more of it than I remember, but I didn't watch it sequentially as it was on the first time I saw it. So now I've been really engaged in the long form storytelling, but I've ripped through I've ripped through seven seasons in maybe 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Really, nice.
I'm in the last, I think I have five episodes left. But I've done a real deep dive on Deep Space Nine in the last few weeks.
That's amazing. In 3 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Don't forget to watch What We Left Behind after all is said and done.
I did. I saw that, last year. I rented it when it came out, but I'm going to give that a rewatch as well.
So wonderful.
When that comes out, when I finish. Not when it comes out, it's out.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that you're kind of binging through DS9 because you're enjoying it so much. It's my favorite Star Trek show. Would you say, Brandon, it's your favorite?
100%.
Yeah. Chrissy, I forget which is yours. It's hard to tell.
I have a hard time saying anything other than TNG is my favorite, but it's a very close second, if not equal.
Okay, so yeah, we appreciate that. Yeah,
it's hard because Voyager is my first love because. Mm-hmm. It's the one that I watched from beginning to end as it aired, and I knew that it was sort of Monday night television for me, and then I waited for the next season to come. And I love TNG, but again, I didn't watch it as it aired, and I felt spoiled because it was on every night on BBC Two or Sky One. And so I didn't have to wait for those cliffhangers. It was already sort of there for me.
And that's because it was delayed? Because I know for TNG, it was delayed a couple of years for the UK. Was Voyager like that too?
No. Voyager, I feel like, was pretty close to when it aired.
Okay.
But around that time, you know, the internet wasn't really huge then, or I didn't have access to it like people do now. And so I never really sought out spoilers, and I wasn't aware of how far ahead American programming was until I watched 24 and Lost, probably around 2002, 2003, because I got the Lost box set on DVD before it even aired in the UK, but it had been released in America. And the same for 24. It had aired for a full season in America, and then I got the box set and destroyed it. I destroyed 24. I'm terrible with binging.
That's not terrible. That's exactly what you're supposed to do with binging.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you so much.
Nice. So Dom, getting back to the role as Mr. Vup. So you talked about it a little bit, but that was a new species to Star Trek, the Beta Inari that you say like are these big, intimidating kind of lizard-like aliens. And we're told they have over 1,000 olfactory glands. They can smell a lie and they can smell other things. But we don't get too much more information besides that on the species during the episode that you were in. I'm just curious if you constructed some kind of backstory for Mr. Vup or, you know, what you thought the species would be like in order to help you play the role.
Not too deep. When I went for the prosthetic fitting, Neville Page, who was the head creature designer, the Inari had been introduced in Voyager. And so his designs were sort of based off the two appearances that they had in Voyager. But he said, but hey, these are Beta Inari. So these might be distant relatives of the Inari, and they might just be in the Beta Quadrant. So, you know, we're taking liberties, and we discussed, again, in that first prosthetics meeting with Neville, whether I was going to have long hair or a ponytail or piercings or tattoos. And then sort of they went away and I was just so happy to be there. I was like, I'll do anything, whatever you want to do, I'm on board. But in terms of sort of creating a backstory for a species, no, I didn't delve too deep into that. I guess the most work I did was on the sort of physicality and the way that I moved, as opposed to any, now I sound like a terrible actor in saying, no, I didn't do any backstory work.
No, that's fine. It's just, I know sometimes that does happen for certain roles that I was just curious about it.
I think the Bates Renari have been popping up in the Voyager novels. I think they've been making appearances in there because I think the writer of Stardust City, Rag, wrote a couple of Voyager novels.
She's written, that's Kirsten Beyer. She's written a bunch of Voyager novels. I think 10 by now, something like that.
Yeah, and I think she's used the Bates Renari in the novels, from what I've been led to believe. And I think Neville mentioned it, that it was a favorite of hers, and so it was bound to make an appearance on screen if she was writing the episode. Yeah, and then, you know, with being on set and the way it was, I was moving or moving my head, then it was in discussion with Jonathan Frakes about what he would like to see on screen as well. And, you know, him... He's so warm and so open, and him saying, have fun, you know, and try this and try that and play around with this. So it's always, I feel like it's a collaboration, you know, when someone's written something and then someone else is designing something and the director and then the actor is bringing something. It's a big collaboration as opposed to just the actor saying, well, this is the backstory that I've made and that's what I'm going to run with. Mm-hmm. I guess I feel like I'm in a real roundabout way.
No, it's fine. I think it's really interesting just to hear about that. I mean, and also you've mentioned something I don't think we even picked up as we were watching the episodes, because on this podcast, we would watch the episodes and then we would do like a really deep dive into like the different connections and our thoughts and, you know, for 2 hours plus oftentimes. And I don't think that you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, Brandon or Chrissy,
no, this is news to me too.
Picked up about the Inari because I forget about that species because they're mostly in the Voyager season 7 episode Nightingale, which I tend to forget a little bit, and in the Void. But like, wow, I hadn't even made that connection or thought about it. So brought up something new we didn't even bring up in our very lengthy discussion about the episode. So appreciate that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So I had a question about that. So I remember specifically when we were discussing Stardust City Rag, talking about these 1,000 olfactory glands and whatnot. And I'm like, I think this alien species would have a hard time functioning having that sensitive of glands and whatnot. Because when we saw T'Pol in early Enterprise, she's in the room with Porthos and she's like making faces and stuff like this. And so we know Vulcans already have a heightened sense of smell, but to have a race that has that enhanced of a smell, I was like, holy smokes, how is this guy even functioning?
Mm-hmm. I function.
You function.
I guess it's, you know, it'll be the same for Data or... For the Doctor, with those characters with so many subroutines and so many things going on. I guess it's a species you're used to. It. Maybe he can turn it off and on. Maybe it's a skill. Like, he can choose when to... That's what I'm going to believe. That's my backstory. He can choose when he can turn it off and on. But yeah, still just a delight to play.
Like sitting in a noisy room and being able to focus in on the person you're sitting across from.
Yeah, that makes sense. Exactly.
I'm just really curious, since you had, you know, talked about watching TNG and Voyager as your favorite series, you got a chance to work with Patrick Stewart and Jerry Ryan. So what was that experience like?
Oh my gosh, so good. I mean, first of all, the first person I met was Jonathan Frakes. It was like, you know, I feel like each step of the process was me freaking out a little bit more as different pieces of information were revealed. So, you know, it starts out with, oh my gosh, they're making Star Trek Picard. Oh my gosh, I got an audition for Star Trek Picard. Oh my God, I booked Star Trek Picard. Oh my gosh, Jonathan Frakes is the director on my episode of Star Trek Picard. And then getting the script and realizing, oh my gosh, I'm in a scene with Patrick Stewart. And then realizing that Jeri Ryan was going to be there as well. So it was like a thing on a thing on a thing on a thing on a thing. And then just to be on set with them and seeing the rapport that Jonathan Frakes and Patrick Stewart have together, and how warm and how open and how casual they are. It was such a warm set. Everyone was relaxed. It was so welcoming. When I first met Jonathan, you know, I said a little earlier on that sometimes you never know as a guest star when you're just coming in for one episode or two episodes how the set is going to be, and you sort of have to feel it out and see how warm and open people are. And when I first met Jonathan, he threw open his arms and said, "Welcome to the family." And from then on in, it was such a delight. And in between takes, everyone would sit down and just be chatting together. And Patrick would be talking about tours of the theater that he'd done in England, and he knew my hometown. He knew Stoke-on-Trent, which not a lot of people know. And he said that he performed there, and we chatted for a little bit about Stoke-on-Trent. And then I chatted with Jeri Ryan and said, "Oh my gosh, Voyager is my show." And she was so warm and so lovely. And because it was a big secret that she was going to be on the show, when we were filming on the Universal backlot, they were sort of shrouded in these huge cloaks. And so we would scurry to and from base camp to set together. So yeah, just the whole thing. I was giddy the entire time I was on set, just pinching myself. And that's just as a side story. Back in, gosh, when did Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. start? Was that in 2012, 13, maybe?
Thereabouts. Not 100%.
I did just a really tiny, tiny role on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. back then in the fourth episode of the first season. And when I booked that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. I'm going to be part of like the Marvel Extended Universe. This is cool. And then I got to set, and the director that was supposed to direct the episode wasn't available. And then the PA came around and was like, "Dummy, let me introduce you to the director. This is Roxanne Dawson."
Oh, awesome.
Cool.
And then again, like in the moment, I was like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." And I was so professional. I didn't mention Voyager, but I was internally doing backflips because I was just, and then because I was working with Roxanne Dawson, that eclipsed the experience of doing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I was working with, you know, someone from Star Trek.
And she's a really great director too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does a whole lot, and so many, what I love, and it's something that I would love to go in the direction of as well. So many actors from Star Trek, you know, they start off and then they branch off. Robert Duncan McNeil is directing a whole bunch now. Obviously, Jonathan Frakes, Roxanne Dawson. So it's really nice that you go into a job as an actor, and then you sort of can expand your skill set while you're working on these shows, which I think is so wonderful too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I mean, I actually don't know too much about what Roxanne Dawson has directed outside of Star Trek, but she did some of my favorite Enterprise episodes where she directed. So yeah, but that's, I mean, that must be really something to be like, "I watched you on this show when I was growing up. Now I'm working with you as a director and actor." It must be like a little surreal sometimes.
Yeah. And it's, it is, and it's intimidating in some ways too, I guess. Because, you know, you've idolized them growing up, and then you don't want to disappoint them, and you, I had this experience, when I worked on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, because I loved that show. And then, again, I think this was probably 2012, 2013. And I worked on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And I felt like on that show, I stopped being a functioning human being, because I was so excited to be there. And I was so just, I don't want to say starstruck, but I was, yeah, I stopped functioning. I'm doing it again now. I stopped functioning as a human being, because I was just in awe of being there. And I would ask really stupid questions that I already knew the answer to, just to try and feel involved or show that I was interested in the process, and I wasn't just being weird by sitting in Video Village. And so I, you know, I'd sit there and I'd say to Charlie Day, wait, hold on, you guys write this show too? That's crazy. And I already knew this stuff, and I was just, you know, when you try and ingratiate yourself with someone and it's horrible and cringeworthy, that's who I was on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And, I'm embarrassed for who I was on set when I did something here. Even though they were delightful.
Yeah.
They were wonderful, wonderful people. But now I'm aware, you know, we live and grow as human beings.
Yes.
I met Avery Brooks at a Star Trek convention, and I was a bubbling mess, and I was so embarrassed afterwards when I met him. I'm like, I just made him complete ass of myself.
And it's hard, you know. I'm sure there's still actors to this day that I'm sure if I met in person that I would not be able to act opposite, or, you know, if I got to work with Gillian Anderson or Kate Blanchett, then I don't know what would come out of my mouth, because I love their work. I'm just a big fan of their work.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, what you're talking about, I'm sure that if we were actors and, you know, we were on a Star Trek show or something with somebody that we really looked up to, it'd be possibly a similar reaction.
Definitely.
It's a human, it's a human thing, I think. I think everyone experiences something similar.
Yes. I've had that, as odd as it sounds, I've had that reaction at historical conferences, because you run into somebody who's, you've read all their books, and it's just like, actually, talk to this person. But
Oh, Chrissy, you're such a nerd.
I am. And I wear it like proudly, like a badge.
Yeah, I do too now. I used to, growing up in high school, I loved Star Trek, and, you know, I would, it wasn't a dumb thing to like Star Trek in high school.
Mm-hmm.
It was nerdy, and, you know, I would go home and I had the model kits, and I would make little LED lights come through the windows, and I had the Enterprise D and I had Voyager, and you know. And then in school you have school and be like, oh no, I don't like Star Trek. But inside. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now it's a rage to, like, you know, all those
Nerd culture won.
Yeah.
Well, since you talk about being such a huge fan of Star Trek ahead of this, two-part question. First of all, how did you feel about the episode being what a lot of people consider to be the most violent in the entirety of Star Trek? And have you gotten any backlash or criticism about it?
Oh, gosh. You know, I read up afterwards. I read that the people felt like the tone shifted a lot, because you start out with Icheb, and that scene with Seven at the beginning. And then, you know, you sort of go on this fun space romp. And then at the end, you have Seven going on this tirade, and then you have the murder of Bruce Maddox. And so for me personally, I didn't have a problem with it. And I never felt, I remember reading the script and I didn't feel like it was that jarring. I guess the only difference is there's been dark episodes of Star Trek before, and, you know, as I'm going through Deep Space Nine now and sort of the Dominion arc and Nog losing his leg and the machinations that go on, and you see the sort of the depths that Section 31 and Starfleet will go to win. And even with Sisko, the lengths that he went to get the Romulans involved. But I guess, and then, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum is the fun holodeck romps that the characters would go on. And so I guess maybe it was just jarring for people to have them sort of coexist in one episode together. Yeah. But then maybe it would be too much and too dark if all those things sort of existed in one grim episode, and then the next episode was fully lighthearted. I don't know. I feel like as an actor, that's sort of above my pay grade to ever get involved with, or for me to say, well, hey, hold on, guys, did you kill Icheb on page 3? Because now I don't know if I should do this line. Like, I don't think that would ever be my place. And it wasn't something that I felt there at the time. And in terms of backlash, no. I've only experienced, knock on wood, thank goodness, love and sort of the embrace of Trek fandom, which has been so delightful, and everyone's been and so nice and so warm, which is the only way that I would want my experience on Trek to be, I guess. So I'm very grateful for that.
Oh, that's glad to hear that.
That's good to hear. I mean, I think we were just curious because it certainly triggered a whole bunch of discussion and people on both sides, whether you love it or hate it for the violent content. And we had an interesting discussion on this show among the three of us about that as well. So I think it's something that it's an episode that really stands out as quite different from a lot of other episodes. And so I think it's something that will get talked about for a long time.
Sorry. I hadn't
thought about that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, please. After you.
I was just going to say the way you framed it, that it was you have the horrible, gory violence, but it's also intermixed with the humorous ridiculousness that makes it more dealable, I don't want to say more palatable, but I hadn't thought of it that way. So I'm glad you brought that up because it's a different way to look at it.
For me, I'm engaged in that kind of storytelling as well, I guess. Being raised on Buffy, that would swing the pendulum that way and swing from horror to comedy, and the X-Files did the same sort of thing where you would have horrific elements and comedic elements within the same episodes. And so it wasn't too, I didn't feel like for me it was too jarring, but I guess in hindsight, Star Trek hadn't really sort of threaded that needle within an episode before. But it wasn't something that I personally had a problem with, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That's my good answer. I'm sticking to it.
You don't have to caveat it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fine. I think we're just curious about it because it got quite a bit of discussion. Probably especially for the first scene with Icheb, because I think that was especially gory for Star Trek. And I think a lot of people were quite surprised in some ways by, like, all of the stuff that was shown instead of maybe implied as it might be in other episodes. So,
right.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, it's maybe something that was necessitated on screen to justify the length that Seven went to towards the end of the episode, because if you weren't privy to exactly what happened, then her going on a sort of tirade at the end might not have rung as authentic if we didn't see what Icheb and she had gone through. So I don't know. You might pull a thread and pull one thing out, and then, you know, her confronting Bejazel might not have the effect that they wanted, or I don't know. That's beyond my control.
That's fair. I actually had something that I was thinking about. So of course, you know, you're in this episode as Mr. Vup. He dies. So that's the end of that character. But I mean, there is a great Star Trek tradition of an actor playing multiple different characters. I assume you would be up for it if there were some way for you to play a different character on season 2 of Picard or some other Star Trek show, right?
Oh my gosh. Yes, please.
I mean, I'm not saying I have an offer for you. That's not something I can give, but
am I hired? Is this it? Is it happening all over again? Without a doubt. And it's fine. I die on all of my sci-fi shows.
Really?
So, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Flash, Magicians, Doctor Who, all of my genre shows I die on.
Okay.
And the Neville and the James McKinnon, the makeup and VFX team were so, so good. And at the end of the episode, I think I was in makeup. I think I went through the makeup process 6 or 7 times. And by the end of it, they had said, "Oh my gosh, you're so comfortable in the makeup. We'll let production know that if they need another alien, that you're comfortable, and we already have your mold, so we can just pull out of storage and we can just do a different effect on your mold, and it will save production money." I always take those things with a grain of salt because you never know. But my gosh, I would in a heartbeat. Absolutely.
Well, let's speculate a little further. If there were an existing Star Trek alien species that you could play, what would you be most interested in?
Oh boy.
And keep in mind that we are gonna cast you as Guinan's manager for her bar. So you get to work directly with Guinan, okay? So let that influence your decision.
Gosh, I mean, from a purely selfish standpoint, I would love to be a human on Star Trek so that I could say, "There's my face. That's me. That's genuinely me on Star Trek." I love the Hirogen. And you know, like playing casting director, they're big, and I could probably play Hirogen, I guess. Gosh, that's a hard question.
Okay.
From a selfish standpoint, I'm going to say human. I'd like to be a human Star Trek.
Can you talk a little bit about the makeup application for your character and like the costuming and whatnot? And then your voice is different on the show. Was that your voice or did they digitally alter it?
Let's talk about it. The voice is my voice, and I go into American and I lower my voice, and then the teeth affect the way that the speech comes out as well. And then I did go into ADR a few months later. ADR is where you go in and you clean up lines that an airplane might have been going over or if it was noisy on set. And we did a lot of ADR, where I was making my voice go deeper and deeper and deeper to overlay on it. And then we did other tracks of ADR where I was sort of doing high pitched line readings, and they were going to try and blend them together. And I guess they didn't end up going, that direction, but yeah, we gave them multiple versions of line readings. And it's funny when you get to ADR, when you're on set, you just deliver the lines the way that you deliver them. And then you get to a recording studio and you have to match the lines that you've delivered on screen already. And then you question how on earth you were able to get the lines out that fast or the weird pauses that you put in sentences.
You have to tell us, Dom. So, cause when you're delivering the line on set, you have like the makeup and the teeth and all of that. Did they give you like the set of teeth to put in? So when you were doing the lines later, Probably not, but
no. So yeah, so on set you have these teeth, and then in ADR, you just have to match them, and you say Mr. Quark or Fenrir was whatever it is, and then just having to match that, and then they say, oh my god, great! So we got that version. Now let's do the high pitched, wispy lizard version, and then you have to do it again and match it and be like, whatever the lines are, but it's I enjoy ADR, but I know some actors don't enjoy that process. But yeah, that was the voice process, and the actual makeup process, the prosthetic process, was a delight. I work on another show called The Magicians, and I'm in prosthetics on that show, and that process takes about 5 hours, 5.5 hours.
Wow.
And on Star Trek, everything was done in 2 hours, from sitting in the chair to getting done, because they made a foam cowl that just went over my head, and then it was just my face that was exposed, and they just had a foam application that would go on my face, and then the teeth and the contact lenses, and then my hands were just gloves that they had made, latex gloves that would just come off and on. So it was actually such a quick process. When I saw the initial drawings that Neville had come up with, I was like, oh no, this is going to be, I'm going to be in there for 8 hours. And they were so fast. And likewise for wardrobe, that was a delightful process too. Because they were so excited to be working on it. I think they had someone that had worked on the original TNG that was involved in wardrobe, and they were excited for what they were creating. And it was again, just that experience of people in different departments coming together to work on something collaboratively to make a whole is so enjoyable and so nice. When all these departments just work together and make something so wonderful.
That's great to hear. Wow. And for you to say it's a, you know, delight to go through the makeup, because I know for some people that have done Star Trek, they felt it's a pain to have all the hours of makeup, but,
good to hear. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that after Michael Dorn went through 7 seasons of TNG and then movies and then Deep Space Nine, he must have, the hours of makeup that he must have been through, and so I'm sure his outlook is very different.
Yeah,
but because it was so special I could sit in prosthetic makeup all day, and even on The Magicians, even though The Magicians is a longer process, they are all such wonderful, warm artists and excited to be doing what they're doing that it's still a delight to do. And when you're working in prosthetics and makeup, it's also sort of liberating in a way, in terms of giving a performance. It helps enhance a performance or bring something out of you that you weren't expecting. So it's a lot of fun in some ways. You know, whatever I was doing with my hands is probably a byproduct of the way that I would have to move in terms of how the gloves were fitting, and to just extend my fingers just a little bit more or move my head just a little bit differently to make sure that it reads through the makeup. So it can really enhance and change certain things, I think, when you're in prosthetics like that and bring out really fun, unexpected things.
One question, and this question, it will be different than it would have been in past years, but so, you know, Picard aired, was it January through April? And, you know, oftentimes you'll be part of a show and then you might go out on the convention circuit for, you know, Star Trek conventions and things like that. But of course, you know, this year we're dealing with COVID-19 and a lot of conventions aren't happening, but I know there's some virtual conventions that are happening this year. I'm just curious, both from the perspective as when you were a fan before and, you know, as being a Star Trek actor, if there are kind of conventions that you've attended and what that experience has been like.
I would love to go to a Star Trek convention. I was actually starting to look into Star Trek Las Vegas about whether I would be able to go as a guest. And I picked up a convention agent, but I haven't had the opportunity to go to a convention and meet fans as of yet, although I would love to. The flip side of that is I, don't laugh at me, I get so anxious in crowds that I don't know. I would love to go to Comic-Con. I would love to go to Comic-Con, but I'm so anxious about crowd sizes that I haven't managed to go.
You know, they've been doing some kind of like virtual conventions, including with some people involved in Star Trek. I don't know like how extensive that is, but you know, that maybe that's a possibility. But no, having been to some Star Trek conventions, it's a pretty amazing experience just to be there among so many fans and people that are into Star Trek, and to see, you know, actors and writers and producers and makeup artists and like all the people that are involved in the show. So hopefully once all this is over, you can do that.
Have you been on the Star Trek cruise?
I have not.
No,
but I know a few, so I know a lot of people that have. It's supposed to be a great experience.
Yeah. I think I was reading about the Star Trek cruise because I guess COVID sort of, exploded.
Well, you know, they had one last cruise right before everything really got out of control.
Yeah. And I think I was reading about these cases popping up on cruise ships, and the Star Trek cruise was still going on. And I was thinking, oh no, I hope that.
Yeah, thankfully, as far as I know, that one was fine.
Yeah. Good. The only convention, what convention? Oh, I went to a Transformers convention that was pretty local to me in the Burbank Convention Hall. And that was sort of a micro convention. So I was like, oh, I feel like I could handle those crowds. And even then, I turned up at like 9 o'clock in the morning, and by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there were so many people there, and I was like, oh, I feel like I should get outside now.
I'm like that at conventions too. I'm like, this is too many people. I'm ready to go back to my room for a little bit.
Yeah.
I get overwhelmed. And I'm the kind of person that if we go to a concert, we'll go to the Hollywood Bowl a couple of times a year when they're open. And I'm the kind of person that will sit through an extra 20 minutes and let 20,000 people get up and walk out. And then I'll be like, okay, now I can go.
Yep. I think all of us are like that are part of this right now. But yeah, I feel the same way about crowds.
Yeah.
A bit much. Yeah. So.
Well, do you have any current, well, I don't know if you have anything current because of COVID, but any current or upcoming work that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Yeah, I guess. I worked on a new Amazon show called Them Covenant, which is a horror miniseries. I think it's 10 episodes. I worked on that. I finished that up in February just before everything shut down. And then I guess I did one day on a Nickelodeon sitcom before everything got shut down, but we didn't even get in front of cameras. Oh, so no. I don't know what happens with that. And last year I shot a film called Breaking News in Yuba County, which was going to come out this year. Now who knows? It'll be out sometime soon, one day in the future. And then in the interim, I'm trying to put together a feature film that I wrote, and I'm hoping to direct early next year, a World War II feature. So hopefully that'll all, it's brick by brick, it's starting to come together. So hopefully it'll keep coming together. We'll see.
Yeah, but we're in one of those situations where you don't know when when you could really shoot.
You know, I've been in so many situations through my career where I've gotten excited about something, and I've said, oh my God, I'm going to be in Batman Begins. And then of course you sit in the auditorium and the moment passes, and then, you know, you're not in Batman Begins because you got cut out. That was my first job. And so, you know, from that point on, I've been always very cautious about celebrating something that I've worked on, just in case, because you never know.
Completely understand that. Well, one last question here. If our listeners want to contact you online, are you on Twitter or other places where they can do that?
I am. I think I always have to think about which one is which. I think on Twitter, I'm just at Dominic Burgess. And I think on Instagram, I'm Dominic Burgess 1. I think someone beat me to the punch on Instagram.
All right. But I'm good to know.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Dom, it's been just wonderful talking with you about, you know, Star Trek and so many other things. It's, you know, I think that you're in an episode of Star Trek, you play this character, but I think it made a big impression. Like, I don't think anyone, if you said, like, who's seen Picard, Mr. Vup, they would not know who that is. I think it made a big impression. It was a great character, and really hope, you know, once they're shooting more stuff in the future, that we see you on Star Trek again in another role. Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you so much. I would love to, but even if I don't, this has absolutely been a career highlight for me, without a doubt. I'll always take it forward with me, as really one of the very special moments of my career.
Oh, that's so great to hear. I mean, that's just wonderful and amazing, because I don't think the three of us will ever be on Star Trek, so we can live vicariously through you.
Yes.
As a fan who got to be on the show.
Do it. Yeah.
If you need a stunt double, I can give you my phone number afterwards and we can work that out.
Great. Perfect. Noted.
Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks again so much, Dom, for being with us for this interview today. It was really a pleasure.
No, thank you. It's been a delight. Thanks for having me on board.
Live long and prosper, and don't smell people too closely.
I won't.
All of that. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right.
Well, it's been so amazing interviewing Mr. Vup himself, Dominic Burgess, today. But that isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. Here's what you might have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks.
Not wanting to be spoiled about this book, I would suggest then not listening now, read the book, and then come back later. And then you can enjoy the whole freaking feature of this glorious analysis that we're going to give this.
I shot JR. Sorry, I thought we were getting into spoilers. My bad.
I don't know. I just like woke up from a dream. I was in the shower.
The orb.
But if you think about the fact that Sisko is with the prophets at this time, and Section 31 is going to try to kill the prophets, maybe that's a way for Sisko to re-enter the story and play his role in representing the prophets to overturn what Section 31 is trying to do and to champion that idea of Truidic and end the season with that message that religion is fine for those who want to believe it, and it's also fine for you not to believe it.
Earl Grey.
One of my notes I made on this episode is that Riker is a cosplayer. He likes to put on the native costumes of the planets he goes to.
Yes.
Ewan, I have started making a Riker Angel 1 cosplay. Ewan wants it for SLB.
So. Nice.
Yes! That was one of my notes as well, was Riker's left nipple.
Doesn't leave much to the imagination, but yeah.
To the journey!
Quick snap poll. Suzanne, would you prefer Neelix to cook for you or Chell?
Chell.
Chell? Zach, Neelix or Chell?
Neelix.
Oh. Oh.
I see Leola root in your future. Lots of it.
Oh, yeah. Give me those exotic ingredients. Yes.
Chell is my man.
I mean, you can have... with Chell, you can get, like, all those puns... pun food items that he made.
Exactly, it would be like Bob's Burgers in space.
Wow.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop Apple Podcasts app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. That helps others find the show. And if you could eat more apples, it helps your breath smell better.
That tip today is brought to you by Dr. Brandon Shematala.
And the Apple Consortium that's trying to sell more apples. And if, like me, you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, YouTube, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on Picard and any Star Trek aliens you'd like to play. And there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. And I just want to emphasize, I have no pull. I can't get you work as a Star Trek alien, but if you want to tell us which one you play, if I did, that would be fine.
If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to a show and select a line. That will come right to us. You can find us. You can also find the network on Twitter and Instagram at trekfm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. So, Chrissy, where can people contact you when you're not eating spicy meat for breakfast?
Be good. Right. So in addition to here on the line, of course, you can find me in the Babel Conference and on Twitter at The Goddess Livia. That's T-H-E-G-O-D-D-E-S-S-L-I-V-I-A. And you can also follow my work as an historian by liking the Facebook page. My fellow historian partner and I run History with the Zilagis. And Zilagi is spelled S-Z-I-L-A-G-Y-I-S. And that's where we post about our historical research. And the Ancient Aliens is BS thing is on hiatus for the moment because we've started a new project where we're writing short blogs called Historical Musings, where we are connecting current events to historical context. And that is on our brand spanking new shiny website called historywiththezilagis.org. So if you want to read some stuff about how the things that we're dealing with now can be traced back hundreds, if not a thousand or so years in some cases, look us up.
Sounds awesome. So I thought you were going to say for a moment, Ancient Aliens is BS is on hiatus because the History Channel has a new show about modern aliens and you're going to call it Modern Aliens or BS. But
that's also true. They do modern aliens on that show too. It's just, anyway. All right. Well,
so let me ask you this, Chris. Did you just think aliens are BS in general?
No, not in the slightest.
Okay.
I don't find the concept that they came here and caused early humans to create the concept of gods to make sense outside of the world of Star Trek.
Yeah.
In Star Trek, I love it.
So you're not against the principle, but the things where have very flimsy evidence, right?
When it's getting into human historical context, it's a whole different thing. And it's because of how it's used. And you guys can read, go to the website, read the stuff. But usually it's just because it's used in a very racist way for a lot of it.
These ancient people couldn't have done this. They had to have help from aliens, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We have
to question how the pyramids were built, but everybody knows how, say, Notre Dame was built. Mm-hmm. Come on. Mm. Yeah.
So then how do you feel about Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull?
That's a lovely movie. It's not the best of the group.
That's
helped
a true
Dan
statement.
Aykroyd sell vodka. I mean, there's a lot of elements to it. Yes. All right. So, Justin, where can people find you when you're not thinking about tripping over your words, meeting somebody from Star Trek in person?
You know, it's a funny thing. I didn't mention it when Dom was talking, but I've always had the experience when I've been at a convention that I'm not really like nervous or worried at all, because my experience when I've met people who are like celebrities or acted in Star Trek is they're just regular people. So it actually doesn't make me too nervous, but I don't know. But
Cool.
If I'm not doing that, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek and the smoked meats I can smell on your breath. And you can find me hanging around the Babel Conference on Facebook. So, Brandon, where can people contact you when you're not making the connection so that you can be Dom's stunt double in the new Star Trek series, Beta Inari, the Mr. Vup Chronicles, that show all of the time before he died?
Oh, that's right. I forgot to give him my phone number. Dom, if you're still listening, it's 1-800-BIG-MAN-HELP.
Wait, don't dial it.
You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me over on the Nerd Party Network with a show called House of Fincher that I'm doing with former hosts on the network here, Tristan Riddell and John Mills. We're going over all of David Fincher's films in chronological order and leading up to his new film, Mank, on Netflix. Very excited about that. That's been a whole lot of fun, that project. You can find me on the Fandom Podcast Network, as well as in our own independent feed with a show called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, where my friends Chris and Tom and I, we cover all of Hitch's films in chronological order. And then also on the United Federation of Podcast Network, you can find me with Zach Moore, another former host of Trek FM. We cover movies, remakes, and sequels on a show called Franchise Fatigue. And we're, I think we're right now smack dab in the middle of either the end of the Unbreakable trilogy or the start of the Planet of the Apes trilogy. I'm not quite sure when this episode's going to drop, but those are our next two anyways. And then stay tuned, as I might be making an announcement for something else coming soon. So we'll just leave that as that for now. Keep your ears open, you Vulcans. If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows... Oh, Vulcan, that's a good little thing there that came off the tip, hey? Yeah. if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. Available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
And we'd like to take this opportunity to recognize our current associate producer, Norman Lau. Thank you for supporting Trek FM and especially The Line.
So join us next time for another episode of The Line.
It is possible to commit no mistakes and still lose. That is not a weakness, that is life.
That's surprising, and I don't like surprises.
Man, that's a terrible Mr. Vup. I'm so sorry, guys.
No, it wasn't.
I thought it was good. Yeah.
Thank you.
But if both you guys could go and brush your teeth, this has not been very fun.
So my breath is so bad that it is traveling through my computer, through whatever wires or the internet that it needs to, all the way to you. Where is it coming out? Where's the smell coming out of your computer?
My microphone.
It's coming out of your microphone? I'm so sorry. Yeah.
I don't think that's Justin. No.
That's some really crazy alien technology, Brandon. Where'd you get it?
Forcus 3. Along with this drink that's green.